For the past 30 years, we've seen a quantum leap in the intuitive, creative, and abstract thinking abilities of children, as well as an unprecedented rise in incidence, of course, of ADHD, dyslexia, autism. What does that all mean? In a moment, PMH Atwater joins me again. We'll talk about her latest work, Children of the Fifth World, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Now, for those of you who are brand new to the program, let me tell you about PMH Atwater, one of the original researchers in the field of near-death studies, having begun her work back in 1978, an international authority on the subject, as well as an experiencer, died three times, author of more than 20 books, has served two terms on the International Association for Near-Death Studies on that board, accomplished runecaster specializing in the yin, or the feminine approach. And here she is back on Coast to Coast. Hello, PMH. How are you?
Well, I'm fine, George. It's been forever.
It has, and it's good to have you back.
Oh, it's good to be back.
You know, I want to talk with you about so much, and we're going to get into Children of the Fifth World in just a moment here. But when you started back in 78, was it your did you die before that, those three times? Is that what got you interested in this?
Well, I was told to do it. That was in 1977. I died twice in January, once in March. It was the third one in March where part of my scenario, part of what I experienced, was a voice that spoke to me. It was, how do you call a voice like that?
Yeah.
You know, it was a big, 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 immense, universal, you know, filled all of creation kind of voice. And that voice said, and I quote, "Test revelation. You are to do the research. One book for each death." Book number one was not named. Books two and three were named. I was shown what was to be in each book, but not how to do the work or how long it would take me. And I revived. And, you know, what a lot of people forget when they're talking about near-death experiences, is that these experiences, most of them, come from trauma or violence. So when you're through with this otherworldly adventure, you've got a body to rebuild. And it took me a year to, well, I was one of those that had to relearn how to crawl, how to stand, how to walk, how to climb stairs. Hmm. Saw the difference between left and right, see properly, hear properly, and rebuild all my belief systems. So I had a big job to do. And it was the following year then when I met Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, believe it or not, at O'Hare Airport. Her plane was delayed. And so the two of us sat on a bench and started visiting like a couple of little schoolgirls for over an hour. And I told her about my experiences, and she said I was a near-death survivor. She never used the word experiencer. She never said a thing about Moody, Raymond Moody, or his book. She told me about the pattern for the experience itself and validated my experience. She said, "You're definitely one of us, or one of them." And, you know, it's so great to be validated, especially by Elizabeth, but you know, what we talked about, in my mind, created more questions than it gave me answers. And it was after talking with her that I began my work.
Well, and great work that you have done. And at that time then, I mean, you're really a pioneer now. PMH.
Well,
I'd never heard
of Moody or Life After Life or the so-called classical model, which, by the way, is not very classical. Never heard of any of this. And I've been doing this for about 3 years or so. When Kenneth Reed happened to come across a little book I wrote with the title called "I Died Three Times in 1977. Now, isn't that an original title? I only printed 50 copies. You can now get it off Amazon.com. It's just a little book about my own experiences. But how he found it in a Hartford, Connecticut bookstore, I'll never know, but he did, and tracked me down by telephone, came over, stayed overnight with my husband and myself, and the next morning he said, You're ahead of all the rest of us. You know more than we do. You've got to come up to Connecticut and meet your peer group. So that's how I got started.
What have you concluded about what the other side might be?
We're kind of jumping here. I thought we were going to talk about the kids.
Oh, we'll get to the kids. We got 3 hours with you.
Yes, we got. Good.
You're not going anywhere.
Because I got a lot to say about the human race and how we're changing. What have I learned about?
I mean, after all these years, I got to believe you've concluded something about life after death and what it all means.
Well, lots of them. Lots of them. You know, if I get started talking about that, and I want to say that summary piece that I did is a book. It's called Near Death Experiences, The Rest of the Story.
Mm-hmm.
That book got me in a lot of trouble, by the way, George.
Oh, why?
Well, up to chapter 16, people loved it because I'm really getting into the rest of the story about the research.
Okay.
And then on chapter 16, it's called Intensity is the Key. And from there on, I really bring everything together and look at the experience as few, in fact, I think, I can say no one else has done. Because, you know, the idea of the tunnel, hardly anybody experiences the tunnel. I do not consider the tunnel to be a signature feature. You know, in that Gallup poll survey that was done in 1982, it was a scientific survey, only 9% of the people ever had a tunnel. In fact, in most of the world, most of the world's people who have near-death experiences, and by the way, it's everywhere, all ages, most of them don't have a tunnel.
Hollywood would make you believe everybody has a tunnel.
Well, you know, all of this stuff about the near-death experience comes from the media sensationalizing Raymond Moody's book. That's where it comes from.
Good point.
But if you're going to really look at the experience, then you're going to start recognizing things that I think are far more dramatic than what the media is talking about, what the public is talking about. These things that are really popular now on television, they're all based on people who are in the hospital and, you know, are hooked up to the machines so that we can have proof. Most of your cases don't happen in hospitals. They happen on the accident scene or, you know, out in nature or on the streets or in a doctor's office or emergency wards. They happen somewhere else. Most of the cases do not come from heart attacks. Most of the cases do not come from surgery. And, you know, we look at those cases, television does, because it's great copy in the sense that, you know, it gives you a good show and you've got something to say, this is credible because, you know, they're hooked up to these machines and then doctors and nurses were there. So we're missing a huge amount of cases when we're just focusing on that. And another thing that we're missing is what happens to children. These experiences happen even to babies. In my book, let's see, what is it called?
And how do we know what happened to babies? They don't talk to us.
They talk about it when they're proficient at language, when they're a little bit older.
Okay.
And many of them, well, they start showing the after effects. You know, the after effects are both physiological and psychological. You have physical after effects as well as, you know, the more psychological kind. You know, everybody's familiar with losing the fear of death. They become kinder, more loving, more humanitarian, more service-oriented. They're not realizing that it changes brain structure and brain function. It changes the nervous system and the digestive system. It changes skin sensitivity. Many of them come back with electrical sensitivity. because it changes the electromagnetic field around the human body. So we're talking here about substantial transformative changes that happen to most people. Not all of them, of course not, but most people. So we're looking at something really big, and most scientists really won't tackle the really big stuff because it makes them nervous. Why does it make them nervous? Because it shows that science doesn't know what science thinks it does. For instance, one of the after effects is synesthesia. Synesthesia is multiple sensing. It's like, you know, people who see number, maybe see music, hear numbers, and smell color. The idea of conjoints, all the senses operate together, or maybe a few of them do together. This is one of the typical after effects of near-death experiences. It's really commonplace, for instance, for an experiencer when they're out shopping and they want to buy a particular painting for their bedroom, they'll buy it for how it sounds, not just how it looks. That's multiple sensing. Well, if you, looking at that as a typical after effect of near-death state means major neurological changes in the body. If you look at that, it threatens science.
And science doesn't
like that. Because it's saying that science does not know really what the physical body is and what the physical body is capable of. A lot of these things that we call psychic abilities are natural, normal extensions of faculties normal to us. And science, you know, doesn't want to look at that. They don't want to see it because it's a threat to science itself. So this is what I do in the second half of the book. I say, all right, guys, you know, you want to fool around with all the little bitty things, you know, eyesight, the tunnel, you know, sounds, oxygen deprivation, anoxia. You want to fool around with all the little things. Wait a minute here. We have to look at the whole picture and everything that's happening. We have to look at the after effects, all of the after effects over time. We have to look at adults and children, and no skeptic has yet done that.
Yet.
Not one on the entire planet. No one. And so your skeptics come out with all these little reasons, and they're very proud of themselves. You know, it couldn't have happened because. And they're looking at one little aspect, and they're saying that explains the whole experience. They're not looking at the whole thing. They're not looking at the whole picture. And the kids really screw them up. You know, in my research of kids, let's take 277, half of them could remember their birth. And in those...
that's amazing.
With those people, where, you know, I could check with mom and dad. I never found an error. They were absolutely correct. George, one-third of them had pre-birth memory. That began around 7 months in utero.
That's amazing. I go back 18 months. That's as far back as I can remember.
That's quite a ways.
Yeah, but that's not bad, no. And it's only one episode I remember. It's my mother going to have birth of my sister. But I remember the coat she was wearing. I remember that they had my uncle watch me. And it was in the dead of winter in Detroit in January. And off they went. And a few years later, PMH, I described that to my mother. She said, Georgie, you can't remember when you were 18
months
old.
Oh, little kids can remember a lot.
I said, Mom, you were wearing this coat. You went out this way. And at that time, we were all living with my father's mother. In those days, everybody lived with everybody.
Yeah, right.
And I described it to T, and I said, and you had Uncle Karim watching me. And she just stopped. And she said, you remember all that? And I said, yeah. I said, I remember you just going out the front door in a rush with your white coat flowing. And then I said, Mom, you don't wear white in the winter, by the way. And she just cracked up. She agreed finally that I remember that at 18, but I don't remember anything before that. And that's the only episode I remember.
Well, you know, in the book, The New Kids and Near-Death Experiences, the frontest quote in that book is by John Leona. And John Leona had his near-death experience inside his mother's vagina as he was being born.
That's an amazing story, too.
And he drew pictures of it.
Years later, obviously. What is it about the brain that allows them to remember these things at that age?
Well, we're smarter and more capable than we think we are.
We're little tape recorders.
This is one of the things that the near-death experience shows, that research on the near-death experience shows. And I think it's a big thing. And what it's showing is that from research on near-death experiences, we're now learning more about life than even death. And what we're learning is that we as human beings are far smarter, far more capable, far more gifted than we think we are or that we were ever trained to be. That the average person is psychic. The average person is a genius. The average person is a very creative, innovative, incredible human being. We're just capable of so much more.
Well, we sure are. We're going to talk in a moment about the book then, Children of the Fifth World, after we come back from the break. But what have you been doing lately? Beyond writing these books and doing research, what have you been doing for fun?
Do you really want to know?
Yeah. Well, can we? This is live radio.
Okay. Okay, I'm going to tell you.
Okay.
On April 19th this year, I was traveling on a plane to San Francisco to be at the expo there.
All right.
And to give a lot of talks. I don't normally do expos, but I agreed to do one. So I went to the expo there. While on that plane, in front of my face, okay, imagine here. I'm sitting in a plane. I'm minding my own business. And suddenly, I don't even know how to say this. In front of my face, energy starts writing a book. Notice I did not say a being. This is not a being. This is not channeling. This is not a vision. This is not, you know, what we're used to. It is simply energy, as if energy itself had consciousness. First came the title, then came the table of contents, then came the front quotes, then came an outline for 11 chapters, and then came the back matter. And it just kept going and going and going like a broken record.
Hold on. We're going to come right back. We'll talk more about this and get into your latest work, Children of the Fifth World, in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. I think I'll invite Pim H. Atwater to join us in our television show, Beyond Belief. I think she'd do a great job. You can watch it 10 days free. Simply go to this website and do that now, beyondbelief.com, www.beyondbelief.com. Just sign up for the program. They give you 10 days free to watch everything you can watch, and then you make up your mind if you want to continue. It's called Children of the Fifth World, A Guide to the Coming Changes in Human Consciousness. Let's talk a little bit about this, and then we'll talk a lot about that next hour when we take some phone calls later on for you too, PMH. What caused you to dig deeply into investigating young children? What was the focal point for you there?
Well, I started seeing everyday kids, normal kids, typical kids, displaying the after effects of a near-death experience. This, beginning to act like they had had a near-death experience. And this is impossible, George. This is absolutely impossible, that normal kids being born in the normal fashion, no problems, no problems around birth or childhood at all, and they're starting to display the typical physiological and psychological after effects of a child who had gone through a near-death experience. And this so alarmed me that I started digging deep. What's going on here? And what I've come up with is this book, Children of the Fifth World. What I truly believe is happening is evolution in our time. We've got the human race is changing.
Dramatically.
Absolutely dramatically. When we start talking about what's going on here with these children, it's just enough to take your breath away. And that's why so many people, can't get along with them or can't figure them out or can't sell to them or can't understand them. They say, well, it's always this way with every generation, and that's true. The older generation is puzzled by the younger generation. That's always true. It's been it's been like that time immemorial.
And then we get older and evolve and change.
Right. But this time, we're faced with a group of kids, or I should say young people, that absolutely do not match anything that we can poke a finger at, talk about, remember, challenge. They're just breaking all the records everywhere and thumbing their nose at us.
What's causing that?
Well, who's to say literally, but I think truly it's a change of cycles. It's a change. Right now we're in the middle of what is called the Great Shifting. I'm also an astrologer.
Yes, you are.
Forget about the Mayan calendar here for a little bit. We're talking about this great shifting that certainly the Mayan calendar spoke to. But this shifting continues. It's going to go on and on and on. It didn't just end December 21, 2012. It's going on and on and on. And this shifting will clean out and clear out civilization as we know it. It's absolutely turning everything on its ear. And as that occurs, then we're seeing huge changes in the environment. We're seeing huge changes in the planets, in the universe, and in our planet, here, planet Earth. And naturally, we're seeing huge changes in the population, not just because of culture. Let me throw one of these out to you.
All right, do it.
One-third of our children born since 1982, you can say 1980, but about that, 1980, 1982, one-third of them are geniuses. They are scoring between 150 to 160 on standard IQ tests.
At what age?
Most of them start taking those IQ tests in late grade school, junior high.
That's remarkable. Could it be because of social media, the smartphones sending messages back and forth?
This has been happening since 1982. 1982 is when the computer came out, George.
We
didn't have electronic devices then.
No, not the smartphones, but we did have the computers. They started
the
coming
computer
out.
The personal computer came out in 1982. This is when this started.
I mean, I've watched my little four-year-old grandson. He knows more about electronics than I do.
Well, yes, absolutely. And exposure to that, being around that is true. But I'm talking about before we had all these gadgets and gadgets. That's when the intelligence started spiking. Now, this is worldwide. This is not just in the United States. So let's open up our minds here. We've got intelligence spiking with no genetic markers to account for it. This has been heavily studied. There are genetic markers to account for it. It is a sudden rise.
So they're baffled by this.
They're baffled. Now, one person by the name of Flynn came out with this idea, like you, that the kids are more exposed now. They're in child centers now, more of that child-centered kind of babysitter now, and that this certainly accounts for it because you've got kids teaching kids and, you know, giving information back and forth, testing each other. But this is also true of children who are not in child care centers, who are not exposed to the kind of stimuli and interaction that these kids that we talk about are. So we're finding it, again, worldwide, in all cultures, whether they have the stimuli and exposure or not. So we've got this big jump in intelligence. What we're seeing here is, well, you know, there are two genes that build a better brain. One third of our population globally have both of them.
Huh.
Just let that kind of sift down here. And another thing that's really going to surprise you is this also includes autistic children and children with learning disabilities. If you have them take the Raven's test instead of the Wechsler test, the Wechsler test is, and I could be mispronouncing it. If I am, I'm sorry. But this is our standard test. It tests crystallized intelligence, what you've learned. The Raven's test tests fluid intelligence, what you can learn. So if you have autistic children and children with learning disabilities, maybe severe ones, and you have them take the Raven's test, we're getting the same one-third. They're scoring the same scores from 150 to 160 and above.
That is dramatic.
Yeah.
All right, do we have any intervention here? Is there some alien genetic manipulation going on?
No, I don't think so. I really don't. You know, we've got all these books out and all these people out that are talking about the Indigo Kids, the Crystal Kids, Rainbows, Star Seeds, Psychic Kids. And if you look at all of those different books, they're all based on channeling. I have nothing against channeling. But if you really look at all those books, they're really kind of exaggerated. They really don't give you a good picture. What they're doing is they're putting these kids into exclusive clubs of specialness, and that's not where they belong. These are not kids that are into exclusivity, quite the opposite. They're more into inclusivity. So if you take all these labels, indigo, crystal, starseed, on and on and on, toss them, toss every one of them out the door, then take the traits those labels supposedly describe, bunch them all together, and you have the pattern for the new kids. And again, this is a global pattern. So if we really take a look at this, then we're beginning to realize that core genetics are changing. This is why I'm calling it evolution, because I truly feel it's evolution. I truly feel that, you know, if you want a pattern to use for what might be going on, then you can go back in esoteric literature, and you can take all the stories and legends and about root races, R-O-O-T, root. Root meaning core genetics. And you'll find that, again, through various kinds of channeling but also through various kinds of legends and stories from Native peoples, you get this idea that the human race has changed in cycles, huge cycles, just like the planet Earth is going through huge cycles of change. The cycle we're in now happens once every 25,920 years. So obviously, you know, most of us don't remember the last time. And it's not written in our books. These huge, massive cycles. And, you know, the first root race was supposedly a time when more etheric or thought form kind of beings came into the earth plane. And you've got the second, the third, and the fourth Earth race, and we're coming now into that period of not only the fifth root race, but the ascension of the fifth root race. In other words, we're getting a double whammy. In other words, we're getting the fifth root race rising to its highest potential. Now that's really major big.
You don't see anything supernatural about that. Do you?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I believe it's cyclic. I believe we can trace it. I believe we can take a look at it. The psychic part is how we interpret it, especially the early cycles. Because there you have to turn to people like Edgar Cayce or Madame Blavatsky with Theosophy when they start, giving us more detailed explanations of the various root races. Madame Blavatsky in Theosophy, they go back to about 18 million years ago with the first root race. They say that's the entry of spirit into matter, the first entry of spirit into matter. Then the second root race is about 8 million years ago, and they go on with their listing. Edgar Cayce goes back 4.5 billion years ago, so he's going much further back than Theosophy does. But it's pretty much it's very similar to the kind of changes and people, the human race as it was, as it came to be, as it changed over time. In Theosophy, they go up to the seventh root race. Cayce stopped at the fifth.
Why?
Nobody knows. He stopped at number five. Perhaps nobody asked him the question. Sleeping, he brought forth information only when he was asked questions. So maybe nobody ever got around to asking him, one way or another. And according to Cayce, it is now that the fifth root race is coming in full force. Now, when we're talking about full force of the fifth root race, I'd like to really focus on that for a little bit, because when we're talking about the fifth root race, we're talking about the masters of communication, the masters of creativity and innovation. We're talking about the masters of higher knowledge and higher consciousness. That's all fifth root race.
And what are these brackets, age brackets?
Excuse me?
Is there an age bracket in this grouping?
Not an age bracket necessarily. although I think you might be implying history here, if you're looking at this pattern of human beings, you can trace that back to the time of Jesus. There weren't that many around then, but there were a few.
All right. But, I mean, did they all fall into certain categories of age? Were they 20s or 50?
No, I'm talking about birth on. I'm not talking about people that,
categories.
Talking historically here.
All right.
So is that what you're talking about, historically?
Right. So they weren't categorized in segments. From birth on, they were considered
that. Okay. So we're talking about cycles of people. And again, we're not talking about them suddenly being this way in their teens or their 20s. We're talking them being this way from birth on.
Okay.
So we're talking about large movements large movements of people. And every renaissance the world has ever known has had this large groupings of fifth race people that were there. It's like, who do you think started the renaissance to begin with? It was fifth root race people. Then they started coming in again in large clusters in the 1800s, from 1840 on. All of this idea of direct communication with God, that you can heal yourself and heal others without doctors, that's all fifth root race. And that's the New Thought movement. So we're talking about Quimby, we're talking about Emerson and Thoreau. Those are all fifth root race people. Church of Religious Science, those are all the New Thought churches. Those are all fifth root race ideas and churches.
Looked at Indigo Kids, right? The crystals, star seeds, all of them. Anything unusual about all of them as a grouping?
I just put them in the same group, the fifth root race.
They're all in there. Okay.
Right. What I found, George, is if I just call a child a crystal or an indigo, I'm not helping them.
Okay.
I'm misleading their parents. I'm misleading their kids. I'm exaggerating the situation. And I'm not giving in anything that's helpful.
Stay by. We're going to come right back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM.